Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Chasing Tales Outdoors. I am your host, Walt, and thank you for tuning in this week. If you are new to the show, this podcast hopefully is unlike anything you've ever seen before. It's going to be groundbreaking, and it's going to totally ruin all other outdoor podcasts for you. It's not really our goal, but I do hope you enjoy your time while you're here. And in case you haven't noticed, we like to have a good time. Obviously, I'm taking shots at other podcasts. But I am joined by my co-host, Chase, from the other side of Florida. And together, we talk to people hunting, fishing, general outdoors. We do cover it all, and we try and bring you inspiring and encouraging stories and adventures and tips from those people who have experiences that you might benefit from. This week's episode was a hoot to record. I'm probably going to try and keep this intro short, so I'm going to throw it to you, Chase. Kind of give everybody a brief update. What's good in your world? What are you seeing? What are you doing? What's up?
Oh, man, I am doing all kinds of stuff right now. The Florida season, or at least in my area, is coming to an end in a little less than 2 weeks. I'm still on the grind, still trying to I technically have two tags left, but I'm trying to fill one more tag here in my zone, and I'm saving one because I'm coming up on a hunt with you at the end of January, because your area will still be kicking off. I've been doing some saltwater fishing here recently. Went out and caught a bunch of reds, caught some trout, caught some black drum, sheephead. All those things. It was kind of, I was trying to do it as a twofold thing. I was trying to get out, catch some fish, and I was trying to scout for some coastal ducks, but it was so foggy and the conditions were just not great for getting out and scouting for birds. But at least the fishing was good. So that was great. And I got a buddy who's a big duck hunter. So I've been going out with him a little bit, duck hunting and doing some scouting at some local lakes. So that's what I've been up to these last couple of weeks. It seems like it's been forever since we've recorded a podcast. We've had some people where they just couldn't do it in some of the times, so we hadn't put any podcast out. But we're gonna get back at it. We've got pretty much a full lineup coming out, so I'm looking forward to doing some of those podcasts. And then once this season's over, then it'll be scouting for next season. So that's where I'm at. Where are you at, bud?
Dude, I am. The rut is just starting to get spicy over here. I don't have the benefit you do right now of you know, three tags punched and your rut being past due. So I can't, even though I want to be out there saltwater fishing and doing stuff, I've got to stay focused. And my rut is just starting to kick off right here near the house. And in about 4 weeks, it'll start to get spicy just across the river to my west. So I've got a bunch of hunting to go. Probably my rut will extend through, I was looking at the rut map, probably early February. So between now and early February, the first third of February, I'm probably going to be grinding pretty hard for whitetails. But, you know, tonight's podcast actually kind of gave me the boost that I needed. It's been a long season, dude. You realize we've been hunting whitetails for over 3 months now? I mean, that's almost 4 months for you, right?
Yeah, since September 16th.
So. Yeah, a lot of late nights, a lot of early mornings.
Been a grind, for sure.
Yeah.
The beginning of the season kicked off hot, and then seems like the last month and a half here, it's definitely been a grind, which it normally is once you get to that point of the season. Deer have been pressured for 3 months. I don't expect anything less, but I'm still getting after it. Right. And I think the persistence a lot of times when all the other guys have given up and are at home and watching football or doing a lot of those things when they could still be out scouting, or a late season seems to be – it can be a good time because the deer are, have actually kind of gotten back to where they're not as pressured because there's not as many people right out in the woods. So I always try to stick it out, stay on course, because you never know what could happen towards the end of the season. So I'm all about it. And like you said, after listening to Andy talk, who was on the podcast, I was just like, whoa, I'm pumped now. I'm ready to go, ready to rock and roll. Let me use some of these things in tactics. And he dove into a little bit of it with the time that we had. Hopefully we can get him back on, dive in a little bit more. But I think everybody will definitely get something from this podcast. And we'll be able to use some of the tactics and things that he's doing and hopefully find some success.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I won't lie to you. It's been a little difficult with the holiday travels, with 3 months of hunting and getting up early. I've been struggling, but, you know, a couple things occurred to me. One, I got to the woods kind of late the other day, and there weren't a whole lot of people there. And this was a freaking special opportunity hunt. And I was like one of the only people there at 3 o'clock. And that's just, it's absurd. And I think that just goes to show a lot of other people are getting burnt out, even though the rut is coming up. And, you know, then you have Andy sit here and just like, I told you before we started this intro, it was one of those things where I was struggling to be a host because he was like connecting all these dots for me, dude. Like he would say things and be like, you know, I do this here and this there and it produces this result. And I'm like, oh, I saw that there one time. And I remember this over here. And it's like, it was really cool. It was like he pulled a one end of a string that was all knotted up and the string just started to straighten out for you. You know, it was just the puzzle started to unravel a little bit. And so I had to remind myself that I have the privilege of editing and then playing this episode at any point in time.
Right.
So I put on my hosting hat, and I'm looking forward to listening to this as much as you guys are right now. So I say we keep this kind of short, sweet, to the point. Let's thank the people who make this podcast possible.
All right. Well, first we need to thank Tethered. You and I are both using the Tethered system. I think they got something special coming out at ATA for everybody to ooh and ah over. And one of the things that we never really dove in with Andy was, because I know he's using a saddle now. He uses the Tethered setup. So I've had success with it. You've had success with it. So go out. Check out Tethered. You can find them online at www.tetherednation.com, and you can pretty much pick up all of your saddle hunting needs there.
Absolutely. And then, of course, we have to make the people who contribute to this show on a monthly basis, and that's you, our loyal Patreon subscribers. Thank you for tuning in every week and then choosing to financially support this podcast. And if you're listening to this and you think, God, what is this Patreon he's talking about? It's a monthly subscription that you can choose to support the show with a monthly contribution. It's that simple. You sign up, you pick either the $2, $5, or $10 tier. Each tier comes with additional benefits. We post exclusive content over there. Very soon, we're going to be able to do live videos now that I've got internet being ran to the house. There's a whole lot of extras that come in play, and including in that are quarterly giveaways. And we've got some new Tethered gear that we're going to announce here shortly for the quarter one giveaway. I'm super excited about. And on the next week's episode, we are going to announce the winner of last quarter's giveaway, which was Tailwind Puffy Jacket, which is a $200 puffy insulative hoodie from Fleet. Chase and I have been running Fleet off and on all year, actually, and I'm falling in love with several of the items that I have. And we're also giving away two Havilon Peranta knives. These are the knives with the replaceable blade. They pack down real tight. And I'm going to be doing a gear review and posting that gear review first to Patreon as well. So you've got three chances to win just from the last quarter. And this upcoming quarter, you're going to be able to get another probably three or four chances to win as well. So check us out. The link is in the show notes below. But if you're sitting there with your fingers on the keyboard ready to go, it's Patreon, patreon.com/Chasing Tales Outdoors. Give it a look, check it out, and hopefully you feel like contributing to the show. All that money goes right into camera gear, operating costs, and we're growing Chasing Tales with your contribution. So I think with that, Chase, we've covered all of our bases. Let's let them listen to the pro himself, Andy May.
Let's do it.
Well, guys, we are here with a guest that I have been looking forward to for several weeks. Y'all know I look forward to every episode. That's the honest to God's truth. But this one is one that I think is going to be really interesting, one that's going to be really fun. And we're going to be talking to Andy May today. He is on the line. Andy, I know your season has just ended. How are you feeling, dude?
You know, it was a long season. I started early September in Kentucky, and shot my first deer second day of the season of Kentucky, right after the opener, and then just shot my last deer on January 1st, which was the last day of Michigan season. So I've been at it for a few months, and I'm ready to hang it up. I'm had a good season, a good fulfilling season, and now my daughter's starting basketball and I'm coaching that, so all my focus is on that now.
That's awesome, man. So for the people who don't know who you are, kind of give everybody maybe like the brief summary of who Andy May is, where you hunt, and kind of how you got into hunting.
Okay. I'm Andy May, just a regular guy. Nothing really special about me. I don't have any TV shows or anything like that. I guess, if I'm known for anything in my small circle of friends is that, I'm a DIY type hunter. I hunt basically whatever's available. I've never went the route of like leases or, anything like guided or anything like, sole access stuff. So I hunt a mix of, like permission, private land close to home, typically small acreage stuff, anywhere from, a couple acres to 30, 40 might be one of the bigger pieces. And that's all shared property usually with people I don't know. There's a lot of hunting pressure here. So I utilize everything. So I hunt a mix of that type of ground and then public ground. And then I also travel a lot to different states. And, every year I seem to add another state to the mix. And mostly Midwest stuff, but I've started to venture out west. As far as getting into hunting, it's kind of interesting. And nobody in my family hunted. In fact, I actually got into archery first when I was 18. I had some cousins that got into hunting, bow hunting, the year before I started archery, and they talked me into getting a bow. And I actually just joined an archery league and kind of fell in love with archery first. It just kind of became obsessed with it. I have a bit of an obsessive personality about certain things. And I just got really good at archery really fast because I tried to learn a lot. And I was, I was the type that was like, I was kind of naturally pretty good, but, I'm pretty competitive, in nature. So it's like, we're in this league and, it's like, I wanted to win the league. You know what I mean? First time shooting a bow and that was my goal. And I just practiced like nonstop and became a pretty, I guess I'd say an above average archer. And then, people were just kept being down at the archery stop and were like, man, you should bow hunt. So I kind of transitioned into bow hunting. I didn't really have a mentor or anything like that. I just, networked with some friends, like a buddy's parents own 10 acres here. And, this guy's aunt owns 20 acres here, and just kind of started bow hunting wherever I could. And, killed a couple deer my first year. And, I just became completely, enthralled in it. And I loved the challenge. I loved the lifestyle of it. And, every year I've just kind of, my whole thing is, it's something I just want to constantly work at to get better. And, I guess that's my goal. As a hunter, I don't really care about bucks on the wall so much. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I love shooting deer. I love shooting big deer. I love the challenge of it, but I really take a lot of pride in. Just, I just want to keep getting better at it. And it's nothing, you know, I'm not competing against another guy. I'm not trying to outdo the next guy, but it's important to me. And it's just a goal of mine. I just put a lot of time and energy into it. That's kind of my goal, is just to keep having new experiences, new adventures, and to just keep improving.
I'm always intrigued by this, but as someone who got into hunting late, what were your influences in the hunting world? Because I know you said you didn't have a mentor or any families, but who did you read? Because you didn't just, stumble into the woods and start hunting, I'm sure.
Well,
or maybe you did.
You know, I kind of did. I mean, the more I got into it, I started buying the magazines and stuff from the stores, and I'd read those articles, and you see these big giant bucks by these guys, and I guess I read a lot of articles, and I had a lot of trial and error. One thing I'll say that I think benefited me is I didn't have a mentor, and I went into it I didn't have to really unlearn any bad habits. A lot of my friends were taught by their dads and their grandpa hunted bait piles and hunted the same stand every year, and this was this was the river stand and this is the swamp stand, and so they just go to those places over and over, and I have friends that still hunt that way, and that's just the way they were taught, and that's the way that they hunted. I never hunted that way at all. I always really from day one I was a mobile hunter. I had sometimes I would set some preset stands, I did a fair bit amount of that, but what I found was, most of the time I was not in the right spot. So what I started doing was just, moving my stand constantly with the observations that I saw. So I, right from the get-go, without even knowing it, I was moving into, closer to where deer lived, where they spent their daytime. Didn't really have an understanding of, they were, bedded over here or traveling through here. It's just, I just kept moving based on observation, and I hardly ever sat in the same stance. So I just kind of adopted that strategy early on, and I didn't really have to unlearn any bad habits. I just constantly kept moving towards the movement I saw. And consequently, I think I learned a lot about deer. I learned a lot about mobile hunting and being aggressive and making mistakes early on, and I think it just really helped me kind of develop my own style, I guess, and helped me achieve, I guess, what some might consider above average success early on.
Yeah, I think because I myself, this Chase, I started out late as well. I didn't start hunting until I was 22 years old. My father-in-law kind of got me into it. And those first few years, like I said, I was kind of emulating what he was doing. Kind of like a lot of you hunt the same stand a bunch, or hunting over corn piles and things like that. And I wasn't getting that success that I thought I should be getting. And I kind of learned early on that the deer don't do the same thing the entire season. Like, they're constantly moving around. People are planting things in certain areas. They're making shifts throughout the season. And I kind of got mobile myself. I didn't have a mentor telling me I should be mobile. I got a climber, and then I just started moving around. And then all of a sudden I noticed, my deer sighting started going through the roof, and I was like, wow. I was like, it was kind of like an aha moment of, okay, if I want to get better at this, then I'm going to continually have to adapt and make those changes and try to figure out what these deer are doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of same here. You kind of start hunting mobile and moving in on deer when you see them. And what happens is, you go in and you push the envelope a little bit. You go in and you bump some deer. Well, when you do that the first time, you learn, okay, hey, I went a little too far. So the next time you do it, you maybe, you're a little less aggressive and set up a little further back. And maybe next time, you're just out of the game a little bit. You set up a little too far away. So by being aggressive early, I really learned to kind of fine tune my setups and my approaches and my access, because I made all those mistakes like early on of being too aggressive, not too aggressive, you know, moving in too far and bumping the deer. You know, I made so many mistakes early on that you kind of develop a feel of where you need to be. And now I feel like I'm kind of at a place where I can quickly recognize that, you know, the majority of the time. Not saying I don't make mistakes. I certainly do. But I feel like more times than not, I get a good feel for where I need to be and tend to pick, you know, the correct setup a lot more often.
Right. Well, how did you meet Mark Kenyon? Because I think that's kind of how everybody probably knows who you are at this point from the Wired to Hunt podcast. How did all that come about?
So Mark and I live pretty close to each other. We're in the same part of Michigan, Southern Michigan. I'm trying to think how we met. I guess, you know how the hunting community is, it's, you know, word of mouth spreads, you know, when someone, I guess, achieves above average success in an area that most people don't, you know, people talk, right? And people find out, and, you know, you try to kind of keep it low key and secretive, but it's just the way it happens. It's, you know, Michigan's a tough state. We have quality hunting. Don't get me wrong, and don't let anyone fool you. We have good hunting. We have deer, and we have some nice deer. But to shoot mature bucks is very difficult. The most difficult of any state I've hunted, and that's the honest truth. I'm sure there's harder. I know there's harder out there. I know it. I'm not saying it's the hardest I've hunted.
Right.
And, you know, I was having some success, and, you know, you share some photos here and there, and you're down at the archer shop and people start talking. And then if I remember right, Mark caught wind of that, and we got to chatting, and then he did an article, something along the lines of like regular Joe's, you know, having TV type success or something along those lines. But basically it was an article about regular guys that are hunting pressured land but shooting bucks that look like TV bucks. You know, it was something kind of weird like that. But,
yeah.
So we got to talking, and, you know, he had just kind of heard some of the success, and we got to know each other kind of that way. And, you know, for you, it was funny because we became kind of buddies. And he asked me, I mean, he must have asked me for 2 years to be on his podcast. And I just kept saying, no, no way, man. There's no way I'm going to talk about myself for an hour. It's not my way. It's not my personality. And I'm like, who in the world wants to just hear me talk about myself? I said, if you want to talk about hunting, fine. I like to do that, but I don't want to talk about me. But he was persistent, and we became, you know, better friends, and got to the point where I was like, all right, this guy's my buddy. He's asking me, I feel like I should do it to help him out, because he's, you know, he's working hard at it. And so I did that, and it was very awkward. I mean, podcasts are still very, very difficult and awkward for me. But I did it, and I've done a few now since with him, and we've become good buddies. I'm getting a little more comfortable with it. But yeah, that's how I met Mark.
Through things like podcasts. That's how Chase and I actually end up getting hooked up. Mark's good buddy, Dan.
Yep.
Chase was on that podcast. I was on that podcast, and we saw a post about Florida hunters, and we just started talking, you know, and here we are, you know, 5 years later, it's our anniversary, you know? So,
yeah, that's cool.
But, so let's talk a little bit about your season, 'cause you had a pretty special season this year. How many big animals? I was going to say trophy, but I don't know how you quantify a trophy, because it seems like your goal isn't necessarily for antlers so much as it is the pursuits. But how many successful hunts did you have this year?
So early September, I went down to Kentucky for the opener. I had 4 days, I think 3 or 4 days to devote to that. And I shot a nice buck down there on day two. Observed him the day before the season, moved in on him the opener. Wind got a little squirrely. He got alerted, and then I adjusted on night two to an area where I thought he might travel through, and I just made the right call. put a good shot on him. So that was the first one there in Kentucky. Next was Ohio. Next was Ohio. Again, that was another early season kill. This one was a little different. I'll give you the quick version of these. And if you want to dive into one more than the other, go ahead, but I can make them quick. But Ohio was northern Ohio, open farm country, flat as a pancake, hardly any woods, very difficult hunting. Most of the bucks get shot during gun season. It's just one of those areas where it's really hard for deer to survive because there's no cover. The woodlots range from, you know, an acre to 5 acres. That'd be a big piece of cover. And then there's like little ditches, you know, and swales and stuff like that. But it's, there's sometimes miles without woods. It's very open and it's not CRP ground like you'd think, like Kansas. It's very, high quality farming ground. So the farmers are aggressive. They get their crops in early, you know, out early. And, it's a very difficult place. I've had good success there, with glassing because it is so open. And this buck in particular, I glassed a few times, spent a few days driving down there before work, and kind of glassed him a couple consecutive days and saw him going into this tiny woodlot. And then I set up on him, the first time I got wind, it was October 9th was the first time I hunted him. And then didn't get it done that day, but saw what he did and adjusted the next day and ended up getting an arrow in him on October 10th. So that was number two. Number three was actually out west in Nebraska, a mule deer. I don't know, you guys probably don't focus on western stuff too much, but that was kind of your typical spend a lot of time, hours and hours and hours glassing and just trying to spot a mule deer. It's a fun hunt, challenging in that mule deer live in places that are kind of tricky to get in close to them, but they're not nearly as cagey as a pressured whitetail, I can tell you that. so don't let those Western guys fool you. I mean, mule deer are fun, but the hard part is just getting close and finding them, and often the terrain. But once you get in tight with them, I mean, you can get a shot off.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just crazy. But you compare that to a pressured whitetail. I mean, it's like a completely different animal. I mean, completely different. You know, you get away with things that you would never do with a pressured whitetail. And then that was three. So that then takes me to my Michigan buck. I shot him late October. And this is a buck on a small, very small piece of private land that gets hunted by another guy. And this is a buck I knew about. So I had a little bit of history with him in the fact that I saw him last year. I had an opportunity with him last year as a three-year-old, and I chose to let him go, just hoping. I try not to shoot three-year-olds in Michigan anymore. It's a heck of a deer to shoot in Michigan, a three-year-old buck. It's very difficult. I have easier success on 4 and 5 year old bucks in other states than I do on 3 year olds in Michigan, but I still try to kind of hit that age of 4. I'm not like super strict with it, but usually if I do my homework, I can find one that age, at least one. But this buck, you know, I passed him just kind of praying, you know, hoping he'd make it. And he did. And he turned into a beautiful 10 point. And so, you know, I caught up with him late October. And traditionally, historically, the last year, I didn't really identify him as a two-year-old, but it's at three. What I noticed is that he really started using that area late October. And we can get into it a little more later, but that's one of the things I key in on is when individual bucks use certain areas. And I find often that they do that. They keep that yearly pattern in certain areas, and you can almost count on it. So I started hunting him late October, which is when he got active last year in that area. And it was the first time in, first sit in and on a little island coming off of bedding. And I got an arrow into him and made a good shot, and he went down. So then that takes me to, what is that? That's number four. And then the last buck was Maryland. And I shot that late December. I got a buddy that lives in Maryland, and he hunts some suburban spots, you know, on kind of outside of the city. There's some public areas there that I've hunted in the past, and he was doing a lot of scouting. He's a hardcore guy just like us, and he was doing a lot of scouting, and he was glassing a winter wheat field coming out of one of the bow only areas, and he said, man, there's a lot of deer piling in here, and there's some good racks. I'm seeing some good racks. So I made the trip down there and hunted that area, and saw the deer that I eventually shot on the first first evening I saw him. Didn't get it done, got busted by another deer. Made an adjustment on day two, and the deer that I ended up shooting, he made it took a different route, and then ended up adjusting on day three and caught up with him on that other route. So I got an arrow in him on day three. So it was pretty unique. They're all, you know, all kind of different styles, different times of the year, and different strategies. But I mean, it was a good year. They definitely don't all happen like that, but I seemed to get into them this year pretty good and made the right call and had some luck.
Yeah,
that sounds like that's a great season. Good Lord.
Sounds like it. Really good season. Well, you mentioned, like you said, you mentioned that Michigan was, it's a super hard state. You got a bunch of pressure, all of that. So when you were talking about killing your buck, like how do you make a plan, an initial attack plan on a deer? Because apparently you located this deer. So how do you even locate these mature bucks in Michigan?
Well, I use a variety of ways. So I would say I have a handful, maybe more like 6 to 7 pieces of private land that I can hunt. Again, very pressured, and very difficult. In my opinion, like I know there's a lot of guys out there, and public land is the real, kind of in thing right now. And don't get me wrong, I love hunting public. Do, and it's certainly challenging, but when you're hunting permission private land, that's small acreage, and you have another guy, two guys, three guys, four guys, something like that on 30 acres, 20 acres, 50 acres, it's really pressured. And I take what I can get in Michigan, because it's really hard to find a good deer. So I utilize all resources. If I can get permission on an acre, I check it out. If I can get permission on 50 acres with 10 guys, I check it out. I utilize the public land that's close. And, what I try to do, because I work in a school, it's not real conducive to traveling and hunting for long periods of time being gone, because we don't technically get vacation time during hunting season. So I have to do like weekends, long weekends, call in sick a lot during. I get more colds during October and November than I don't know what it is. But when I travel, it's got to be those weekends. But in Michigan, what does work in my favor is that I can get out after work, especially before the time change. I can get out, most evenings if I want to. So what I try to do is I try to build opportunities close to work, close to home, so that I can get out more often and, kind of focus on those areas somewhat, keep tabs on them, be able to scout them more often, be able to scout on my lunch, be able to check cameras on my lunch, be able to glass before work, be able to glass, right before dark, those types of things. Now, these might not be in the best areas for trophy deer. I might be able to get into some bigger bucks, an hour or half an hour, away, but these close, right. These close opportunities allow me to hunt more often and get more intimate with the areas I'm hunting. And if I put enough feelers out there, if I do my job scouting and I'm pretty diligent about, you know, trying to locate, you know, 4 year old deer or older, I can usually find some good ones kind of living under people's noses. It just takes more time. The area I'm in is really high pressure. 4 year old buck, you know, it's just really hard for me to find. It takes a lot of time for me to find one. And some years I don't find one, you know, and then you just hunt the best that you can find. So, that's been a key thing, is being able to build some opportunities around home, you know, and utilize everything. That includes public, that includes permission, private. And, you know, it's funny, like some of the private pieces I hunt are, you know, you get 15 acres and you got three guys on there. You're like, why would I bother? You know, why would I even bother with that? I'm trying to kill a 4 year old buck on 15 acres and there's three other guys out there. But I'm telling you, sometimes you just need that one spot, you know, that one spot where that deer is just cutting that corner, or that one spot where, you know, when those guys are out there, it forces, you know, the buck to this one corner of the river bottom or something. And, you know, I've found success in that. It's a constant changing, and it needs constant monitoring. I don't ever have a property that just produces every year. I don't. They almost always come off different places, new places, or, you know, a spot that, you know, maybe I did kill one there in 2012 or something, and, you know, now there's a good one here in 2018. But, you know, it takes constant monitoring and a lot of searching to find the buck that I'm after. There's no, like, honey holes, I guess I should say. You know what I mean?
Right.
But as far as locating them, I utilize all methods. I glass like a madman. I run cameras. I look for tracks, and I look for, you know, I get on the ground in season scouting, looking for hot sign. So, you know, I utilize all those methods because I have to. Some spots are more open. It's more advantageous for me to glass. Some spots are more thick. It's more advantageous for me to run a camera and kind of, you know, stay out. Some are more, you know, broken up, you know, farm kind of river bottom ground. Sometimes those areas, it's advantageous for me to walk the edges, scout the perimeter, and look for big mature buck tracks. So I utilize it all. You know, and that's one thing I can say about myself. I'm relentless with my scouting. I scout a lot. I scout year round. You know, I love it. I love it just as much as hunting, and I love figuring out new pieces, and just that challenge of, you know, finding a new area and trying to pull a good buck out of there. But in Michigan, it's definitely challenging. I think mature deer are hard everywhere. Michigan, it's just hard to get them to that age. That's all it is. And then it's just hard competing with all the people. I know, you know, hunting in the swamps of Florida or Georgia or Louisiana, I know that stuff is hard. You know, I haven't done it, but I wouldn't want to trade, but
you're not taking my offer from earlier.
yeah.
But the challenging here is just beating the gauntlet of so many hunters. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, you drive down the road in some of this farm country and you see box blind after box blind on top of each other, and tree stand after tree stand, and it's crazy, and it's a miracle that anything makes it. But we do have deer, and, you know, shooting a year and a half, even a two-year-old, you know, some of those two-year-olds look nice, 100, 110 inches, those nice deer. You can shoot those here with a little bit of effort. You can shoot those here, but those four-year-old deer are four and older are really rare, really rare.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, I kind of use a lot of the same approach that you use as far as the scouting, because I feel like the scouting is what kind of gets you there. Almost, I scout probably more than I hunt, I would go to say, because with my job, it's pretty flexible. I work as a firefighter, so I work one day, I get 2 days off. So I spend a lot of that time scouting more probably than I do hunting. And even if, like I said, if I've got time in the morning before work to go out and glass a field or something like that, I'm going to do it, because I know that is what may pay off in the end and helping me maybe either locating a mature buck, or if I've got one located, trying to figure out what that mature buck's doing. And Florida's kind of the same way. I mean, they're I would say we probably have some mature bucks, but it's kind of hard to tell sometimes. You really got to go on like body size and stuff because a lot of places the genetics just aren't there. I mean, there's certain places that, I mean, an 80-inch deer might be a four-year-old. You know what I mean? But we've also got places, I'm lucky to hunt in one of the bigger buck counties in the state where they can get up into that 130, 140, we have guys that kill 150 class deer in certain areas. There's not a lot. I mean, definitely not a lot. Like the top deer for the state might go 150, 160 for the year. And then you'll get a lot, you'll have some guys, but it's kind of in pockets. Like there's pockets around the state that have that kind of genetic and they can get to that potential. But our deer bag limits have been so high for so long that you could just slay deer. So it's just hard to get people to buy into passing on bucks to begin with when they could go out and kill two bucks a day every day for the season. Luckily now our state just instituted is $5 for the entire season, which is still pretty darn high. Yeah, you kill $5 or you kill $3 and two does. Is what our state is. But it's like I said, even here it's hard to kind of locate that like big mature buck. And like I said, I even have years like you were mentioning, like I can't find a big mature buck. Whether through scouting, on camera, sitting for hours on end all over the place trying to find one. And then every now and then there's a year where you may pop up where you've got this giant on your property and you're trying to figure him out. So I love that process and your approach to kind of how you're doing things to get it done in a highly pressured state like Michigan.
Yeah, I can imagine that's really tricky down there. And, I'd like to try something like that down the road, especially after watching Adrian do that. He's kind of showing me pictures and it just looks like it's just a new challenge, you know? And to me, it's like, I don't even care if I would, you know, kill a mature buck or not, but I love the challenge of new areas. And, you know, I'm one of those guys that, you know, I realize, you know, we're all, you know, we all have different opportunities. We all come from different areas. I know that an 80, 100 inch, 110 inch buck out of Florida is a slammer. You know, I know that. And I think any hunter that's really, you know, worth anything realizes that, you know. And guys from Michigan, you know, we're so used to seeing these big giants, you know, everybody, you know, all these guys that are, I guess, are considered experts and big buck killers. I mean, you look, they're all from Iowa. They're all from Illinois. They're all from Wisconsin or Kansas. I mean, all of them. I mean, and, right. you don't. So, I mean, I guess that's my way of saying, like, you know, I saw that buck that, you know, Adrian killed in Mississippi and, you know, by Iowa standards, you wouldn't even bat an eye at it. But I know that that's a big old mature deer, and that's a big mm-hmm. a big boy for that area. And I see there's a guy on the Hunting Beast, I don't know his real name, but I've talked to him plenty of times, but his screen name is PK, and he kills great bucks out of Florida. I mean, he's just a killer. And you know, 115, 100 inch, 125 inch, and I'm just like blown away by this guy because I know where he's hunting and I know the difficulty of it. So you know, we all have different opportunities, and sometimes it's a tough pill to swallow when you're in a difficult state and you see these guys in Iowa just knocking down 160s and then their wife and their kid are knocking down, you know, 170s. And you're like, okay, there's a little different there, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm hoping to draw Iowa this next year. I've got four preference points now, but I'm like, what am I going to do in Iowa? Like this Mecca, I'm just be like, okay, don't shoot the first 130, 140 class that walks out in front of you.
You really gotta hold yourself back. I mean, the last time I drew, I'll draw next year as well. But the last time I went was a few years ago. And in the first half an hour of the first day, I saw three deer over 140.
Good God.
And I saw this 9-point that had to be the biggest one that I saw was, you know, he's definitely high 150s, low 160s type deer. I mean, the first half hour. I'm not right. saying it's like that every time, but like, no. I just saw three deer in the first half hour bigger than I saw the last two, three seasons in Michigan completely, the whole season. Mm. You know, so it's a different world, man. It's just, but it's fun, and those places are fun to go to. And, you know, I absolutely love hunting Iowa, and I love hunting Kentucky, and I love hunting Ohio, and they all have their own set of challenges. But you know, coming from a pressured area, you know, I think, and what you guys are experiencing, and guys from New York and guys from Pennsylvania and Michigan and everything, I think it really suits them well to come from an area like this when you travel to some of these states that have, you know, more opportunity and more mature deer. It does make it feel easier. You know, it really does, because you're used to taking the precautions and, you know, maybe being a little more aggressive. And, you know, I guess just kind of, I guess I would describe it as hunting at a little bit of a higher level, to get onto nice mature deer in those pressured states. And then you travel to a state with a little less pressure. It's just, I don't know. It just feels easier, and not calling it easy by any means, but it's just a different ball game. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, I went out to Kansas probably 3 years ago with a buddy, and of course, I like the first night I shoot like a 120 inch 8-point, which is probably a 2.5-year-old in Kansas. Because, I mean, I'd never shot anything that big with my bow, especially being down here from Florida. Luckily, this year, I finally surpassed that with a buck that I shot with my bow. But I just went in kind of aggressive first night, grunt called to the deer. He came in, and that doesn't really happen in Florida, to grunt call to a deer and them come in. They're more spooked by it than anything else. Came in, and I shot. I was like, oh, well, I guess I just I'm done here. In Kansas, because you only get one buck. But it was just one of those things. I was like, man, and actually, I mean, I hunted because I was hunting with a buddy, and we were slated to stay there for six days. So, and I saw some probably 135, 140 class throughout the hunt. And I was like, well, I guess I should have held on to that tag. But like I said, up until that point, 120 inch with a bow was something like, oh my goodness, I finally killed something this big with my bow. So, but yeah, it was definitely, I definitely felt like it was, I'm not, like I said, maybe easier. It's probably easier for us or something coming from a state where we just don't see a lot of deer, even of that quality. So I can definitely see where you're coming from. And as far as it's not as hard.
I think what it is too, is there's just more mature deer running around. The mature deer definitely behave a little different, you know, because there is less pressure, but there's just more of them around. You're seeing them more. So, you know, whether it's really easier or not, I don't know, but there's definitely more, right. more of the type of deer that you kind of are looking for sure. Yeah.
Definitely. Because they're the bag limits. I mean, they get one buck in Kansas and they're done. I mean, like I said, down here it's five. So there's probably going to be more roaming around. And they have a tag system, and not a lot of people from out of state necessarily can come hunt those, especially Iowa. I mean, they only let, what, it's like 1,000-something people from out of state come hunt the whole state for the season. So I'm sure that definitely helps out.
So I'm curious, you know, you said earlier a lot of things that like, I tried to grab them and like, pin the idea, but you said guys do their homework, and I just kind of want to dig into this a little bit, because when I talked to Adrian, he said that he's never met someone who literally calls the shots. Like he says, I'm going to go in here, I'm going to do this, this is how it's going to unfold, and then it unfolds. So I kind of want to maybe pry into that a little further. When you're making a game plan, I mean, it sounds like you've got a pretty good idea for that deer's behavior up until that point, but then you go on these hunts that are only like 4 days. So are you finding that there's a particular skill set and a certain type of behavior that just seems to translate everywhere you go with like maybe small tweaks? I mean, obviously not asking for the, you know, the keys to the castle here, but I'm just curious, like, what are you looking for? Cause you got to eliminate a lot of places.
Well, let me kind of explain it this way. You know, you see, you talk to hunters that, you know, have certain styles, like, you know, certain guys are, hunt buck bedding, and some guys are, you know, food plot guys, and, you know, some guys are more kind of spot and stalk, or some guys are, you know, mobile hunters or hunt travel routes, that sort of thing. I even know some guys that kill just unbelievable deer every year, decoys. That's all they do all season long is decoys. So I think what I try to do is I try to be very versatile. I think my style is a lot of a mix of a lot of different styles. And I think one of the things that helps me out, and I didn't even really realize this, but people that I've hunted with have pointed it out, that when I go to hunt a new area, I'm pretty good at figuring out what style I need to hunt kind of on the fly. And I'm, or basically what style would be best suited for that situation. And I'm a feel type hunter, meaning, and this is always a weird answer, but I really go with my gut a lot. And what, going back to what we talked about before, you know, when you make the mistakes and stuff, I've talked a little bit about this, on a couple hunting forums, but, you know, I always recommend, especially guys that are kind of, you know, wanting to learn, or kind of maybe in the beginning stages of going after bigger deer, I always recommend being aggressive. Because by doing that, you push the limits. You know, you're going to make mistakes. But what you're doing by this is you're going with your gut and you're being aggressive. I mean, if your gut tells you to back off, back off. If your gut tells you to go in, go in. But by doing that, by trusting your gut, what happens is when you trust your gut and you make a mistake or you're just off, that instinct you felt, that gut instinct you felt, it changes a little bit. You're like, okay, this is what I felt like I should have done, but I was off. Next time I need to do this. So your subconscious instinct just changes a little bit. So the next time your gut feeling is a little different. It's to push in a little further, you know, and so maybe that next time you push in a little too far and you bump that deer. Well, now your instinct develops a little bit differently, and you start to develop this, this instinct where your gut feeling is just becomes right more of the time because you keep making mistakes. And if you don't make those mistakes, you don't develop that. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
Okay. So, you know, I always recommend like just trusting your gut. If your gut says go in there and dive in, go do it. And if you blow the deer out, boom, you learn something. But if you sit back and you wait and you never really pushed and followed your instinct, you didn't really learn anything. And you might miss out on that opportunity. But if you push in, you might kill them. It might be the right call. Or you might push in and make the mistake, but then you just learned. So that's kind of one thing that I always try to tell guys to do. As far as like traveling and developing a game plan, you know, a lot of the areas I go to are areas I'm familiar with. You know, for instance, like I hunt northern Ohio a lot. It's a piss poor area, but I've learned how to hunt it. And, you know, if I put in my time, and I've learned these certain spots, I talk about, getting familiar with areas when they heat up, when the best time frame to hunt that area. Now it might be a whole farm I'm talking about, a whole piece of private farm. It might be a public swamp. It might be this river bottom piece where you have permission on 10 acres. But what I find, like over years, you know, running cameras, observation, hunting, certain areas are optimal at certain times of the year. There's, you know, unless you own a nice piece or have an exclusive lease that encompasses, you know, a certain deer's, you know, 365 days. You know, I don't have anything like that. Most of the guys out there don't. You know, I relate more to the, I guess, the average DIY type guy. But there's certain times of the year where these areas are optimal. I try to find that out. I try to determine that. And then that's when I hunt those spots. So I try to set up my season with areas that are optimal at the beginning of the season. And then I try to set up you know, my mid season with properties that are optimal, that are mid season. I try to set up my rut or my pre rut and rut in areas that are optimal during that time. So like, for instance, there's a spot in down in Northern Ohio. You know, anybody can hunt this. When the crops are up the first few days of the season, there is a, you know, there's a bachelor groups of bucks in there. And that is a great spot to hunt early on. Now, if I was like some of those guys that like, they like to sit back until late October and the weather cools, if I did that and then hunted that place, I wouldn't see a single deer because the crops would be down the woodlot. There's no reason for them to be in those woods, you know, when the food's gone. But by scouting and hunting and running cameras and glassing, I know that when there's corn and beans up in that area, that's a great spot to hunt early. I got a really, really high percentage chance of tagging one early in that area. Not a rut spot, not a late season spot at all. It's an early season spot. And I got other spots like there's this river bottom area that I hunt, loaded with antlerless deer, with does. And you might get a year and a half, 2 year old buck in there kind of, you know, during October. You know, I could hunt that all October, just pounded. I could bounce around mobile doing whatever. There's not going to be any mature deer there from my experience, because I've tried it. I've done it. I've spent right. that time learning that. But come late October through mid November, they're cruising through their big time. So what do I do with that spot? I stay out of it. I let those does and whatever's living in there just live in there and not get bothered and let them do their thing. And then when that spot heats up, I slide in. And it usually doesn't take long for me to have an encounter with a good deer. And, you know, it takes years to kind of learn this. A really good strategy of learning this is just to put a, you know, if you're not sure, put a couple cameras in an area and just let them soak all season. Don't ever touch them. And you can kind of learn a little bit using that. That's one of my favorite trail camera strategies, is just to leave them the whole season and let them soak. But then, you know, so that takes us to, you know, early season. I have, you know, two or three spots that are very high percentage, you know, if there's a good buck there, that I can get a crack at one. And then we go into mid-October, you know, what everybody calls the lull. It's like my favorite time of year. There's spots where I know big bucks gravitate towards in different areas during that time of year. That's when I hunt it. And then we go into late October, you know, the pre-rut, and there's these other areas that heat up. And those areas that I hunted prior are like ghost towns. You know, and then there's better areas for, you know, those first 2 weeks of November. And then you even go into late season. So I try to map out my whole season so that I have optimal hunts, you know, really high percentage hunts in optimal areas for the timing of the year. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it takes time to develop that. And that's why I utilize all resources. I utilize all pieces of private I can get on. It doesn't matter how pressured it is, because what I find is, yeah, sometimes there's four or five guys hunting it. They pound, you know, early season, you know, and then they're out there during the rut, and then late season there's nobody, you know. And then that's where that mature, you know, that might be when that mature buck slides in there, you know, from pressure. So it just depends, and it does take time to learn those spots. But I rely a lot on yearly timing in certain areas, and I really try to figure out when they are most optimal, and that's when I hunt them, and that's the only time I'll hunt them. And it often, if you get that really dialed in, it often doesn't take very many sits to get a crack at one. If you're pretty dialed in with your setups, and you know your access is good, and you're kind of smart about that. But you know, I've most of my deer are killed on that first time in. Not all of them, but a very high percentage are killed on that first, second, maybe third time in. After that, if I don't get them after that third time in, it's just probably not going to happen for me, at least in that spot. You know, and then when I go out of state, you know, it just depends. Like I go to Kentucky sometimes early season because it sets up great for glassing bean fields. You know, I mean, I look for those lush green bean fields, and I glassed before the opener. And I mean, Kentucky's a great big buck state and relatively low bow hunting pressure compared to what I'm used to. And there's some nice deer there. I mean, the deer I killed this year, I'm sure is a 3.5-year-old buck. He's like 125 inch 10 point. You know, he's not a giant, but I was really happy to take him. He is a beautiful deer. But I go down there because it sets up great for early season hunting. Maybe some of the other areas I hunt, you know, aren't so great for early. And then when I go on the, you know, when I hunt the rut, you know, I'm going to areas that are good during the rut. I try to plan out my whole season with timing it when it's most optimal. And then going off of that, if I do kind of start keying in on an individual buck, like around home, I try to learn where they are certain times of the year, not necessarily the property. I don't, you know, I'm focused on the property or two, the properties they use and when they're good, but certain bucks tend to use certain areas during certain times of the year. So if I do have the opportunity to, and I'm fortunate enough to have a buck that I've hunted for a year or two or three, I really start to figure that out, where they are early season. Can I get access to it? Where they are during the rut? You know, do I have permission? You know, are they, you know, on this piece of public on late season? It just, you know, I try to find out those pieces of the puzzle, and it might be a situation where, you know, I only have access to somewhere where this buck is active during a small window of the year, and that's when I hunt him. That happened a few years ago. I shot it was about 160 inch 9 point here in Michigan, beautiful deer, and it was the trail camera data and observation has shown I had a very short window on this area I could hunt in late October, like right around that 24th, 25th, 26th. 3 years in a row, I either saw him or had pictures of him in daylight. Not really any before, and not really after until around Christmas. So I didn't hunt that property at all until that October 25th time frame. And so I had a picture of him 2 years prior on the 24th, a picture on the 26th that same year. The following year, I had several pictures of him between the 24th and 26th. And then the third year, I killed him on the 25th. And he was just in that area for whatever reason during that time frame. And then during the rut, nowhere to be found. I had no idea where he went during the rut. But during the pre-rut, late October, that's where he was. So, I mean, as you can tell, like, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of scouting and experience to kind of figure, you know, these areas out and kind of get a compile, like, a bunch of these spots and information. But when you do that, when you get enough of this information, you can – almost plan a whole season ahead of time, you know, and there's,
yeah,
I a lot of my season is, you know, tentatively, you know, flexibly planned out of, you know, where I'm going to be going after this deer here, there, then, you know, hunting this area during this time, but I'm also very flexible. And I also get opportunities that deer kind of on the fly that show up or you observe, you know, different opportunities pop up during the year that you have to capitalize on. But that's kind of my strategy with around home and when I travel, you know. And then every year I try to throw in some new stuff that's just I'm not familiar with, that's challenging, and just try to figure it out on the fly, because that's important to me too, is just to grow as a hunter and just to kind of have those new experiences, you know.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, like, I feel as you describe things, I'm doing some of them. I know Chase is doing some of them. I'm not doing them very well, honestly. Like, I, you know, listening to my gut, last year it cost me a good opportunity on a deer, and this year I'm finding I'm hunting the same spots too often, and I'm at that, like, third and fourth spot. And actually Chase told me today, he's like, dude, it's time to change it up. You're not seeing what you're supposed to there. You put a bunch of ground sand in there. It's time to, you know, move on to a different spot. But, you know, I think the thing that you said that resonates the most with me is leaving the trail cameras there all season long. I actually did that this year, and it was amazing to watch the progression of this swamp. Basically, the whole premise of it was we have this really deep access in Florida is very, very hard to avoid everyone around here. You know, there's a road going to every patch of woods on all four sides, basically. So you can't really get away from people. It's very hard. And we found this swamp that I'd say is maybe 500-600 yards from the nearest path. And for most of the path, it's probably closer to 1,000 yards. And it just looks impenetrable. And a buddy and I went in there and we hung a trail camera on a little natural like watering hole in the middle of this swamp and had some deer sign there. Nothing crazy. And we hung the camera and I left it there from October 10th when right before the piece of property opened all the way up until December 18th when that little unit shut down, and you had does come by for, you know, all daylight hours. And then as the season progressed, all of a sudden you started to see bucks start to use the area, but it wasn't quite the rut yet, but they were just starting to move and, you know, establish that pattern. And then after that, you started to see early chasing. I got pictures of two deer fighting early on. And then you see the bigger bucks start to come in and claim the does. And then the smaller bucks move back in. It was just really cool to get that educational component of that piece, because now I've got a pretty good timestamp of when those bucks started showing up during daylight hours. And the best part about it was I didn't get a single photo of another hunter. So the whole thing played out perfectly.
Yeah. That's great. Now, so now you have, you know, a tentative game plan of when that area is going to be, optimal to hunt. Right. So
right.
Imagine if you had a same spot like that for early season, you know, mid-October, late October, you know, November, late season. And they could be all different areas, miles and hours apart. But if you had something like that that took you along the whole season, you'd probably have a lot of success, I'd imagine. That's the kind of homework and information that I try to get.
Okay.
So that it's a whole season of very optimal timing, very high percentage sits. If I don't think it's a high percentage sit, if I don't think that I'm going in there and going to kill something, I most likely will scout or sit at observation stand. I'm not one to just kind of, I don't know, I'm going to sit in here. I'm going to bust into this area and just sit it out and see what happens. And I don't really know, you know, I don't like to sit and hope. I want to know that the timing is good, that the wind is right, that my access is good, and that there's the deer I want is in the area, or that I'm in an area that is tends to be good during that time frame.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you start to archive all of this in your head for the different pieces of property, and just basically you apply that, I'm going to call it a gut matrix, because that's kind of what you've got, is you've just got like this feeling of when you should go in and when you shouldn't, and you just apply it after you've acquired and lined up the information, right?
Yeah, some of it is a feeling. Like now, like I do trust my gut. I do act a lot on just what I call instinct, or I guess my gut feeling. But a lot of this is just historical data. It's like literally, you know, the property has taught me when to hunt it, or this area of this swamp has taught me when to hunt it. This river bottom has taught me through years and years and years of experience, observation, trail cameras, hunting it, you know, during the wrong time. It's taught me when I need to be there and when I shouldn't. And then the same with certain deer. If I'm lucky enough to have a deer to chase at 4 and 5 years old, there's a lot of times I have at least a little bit of history with it. It's not like I have like food plots and they've been coming in and I've been watching them and getting them before, you know, and then shooting them. But, you know, I get little pieces from him. I get little pieces. I get a track here. I get his rubs that I believe are his over here. I get a trail cam picture of him over here. Then I get this burst of pictures and sightings of him in this area in late October. And then I find his sheds over here. And then, you know, you build these pieces. Find these pieces of the puzzle. And then it's like, okay, you know, my best chance, if I want to kill this buck, my best chance is to hunt him right here or in this area during this time frame. And that's what I'll do. I just stay real disciplined with it. I won't push him. I won't go in there until the timing's right. If I have access or I know where he's at early season, I'll absolutely hunting him during that time. I love going after individual deer early in mid-October. That's my favorite time to go after an individual deer, up until late October, somewhere in that time frame. During the rut, I do not like hunting after individual deer. I just do not, they're just too random, and you know, I just never know quite where they're at. But if I can get a bead on them and I have access to where they're at early through late October, and I can usually get a crack at them. You know, it's become fairly regular that I can at least get an encounter. You know, I'm getting pretty dialed in with that time frame, and that's a time frame I like, because a lot of guys struggle with that time frame.
Yeah, I can see that.
That's true. I mean, I've been working on that same thing, Walt. I mean, you can attest to that for real hardcore this year. In trying to, like you said, stay out of the spots when they're not good. I mean, if you've been hunting an area, because, I mean, there's one area I've been hunting for, this is going on my 12th or 13th year that I've been hunting there, and it took me forever to kind of realize, like, okay, you're not getting it done during this time. You know when these, because this place is more of like, it's like a doe haven. I mean, there's just loads and loads and loads and loads of does in this area. And like you said, you mentioned that one area where, yeah, you'll see some 1.5-year-old bucks, some 2.5-year-old bucks, but you're never seeing the mature bucks or even catching them on camera. And you're kind of just going in, it's kind of like a hope and a wish and a prayer that maybe something will come in. And I kind of have the rut, I know, kind of dialed into that area. It always seems to kind of kick off mid-October, because Florida, you can't go by any rules of when the rut actually is, because it's different per county, or even across the street it can be different in Florida. So I finally, it's like, okay, don't go in it during this time, or use this time for scouting. Just get way back, scout, and come up with a game plan for when you have, like you said, this historical data of when your big bucks show up. And I've been chasing this one buck for a couple of years in this other spot, and I just had pictures of them the year before, so I was kind of going off pictures of them the year before. And sure enough, I went in that day, and he came out. I had a mishap happen. I didn't end up killing him. He was this giant, probably 130 class, 8-point. I mean, he blew up from the year before, but I know it was the same deer. But I went back to that point, and I was like, okay, you have a trail camera picture of this deer on November 3rd in this spot. You had an encounter with him the very next, the first encounter I'd ever had with him, other than I walked up on him the year before in an entirely different spot of the property. And then he comes in and I get a chance at him on November 3rd, the very next year. So I can be like, okay, well, now I know that I've kind of got that dialed in, and I don't even really even need to go into that area knowing that now. other than maybe having a trail camera running or something like that. But it's kind of opened my eyes. And a lot of times, Florida deer are really hard to pattern. It seems like I've been trying, like I said, for the last 13, 14 years of getting a pattern on deer. And there's a lot of times where you get like one trail camera pick of the deer, and then that's it. Like, they never show back up again. And it could have been just because there's so many does and he was in after a doe that time or whatnot. But I finally kind of got a few deer on this one property that I'm kind of getting dialed in on. Okay, it's like, okay, he's on this side of the property during this time. These are when he's most daylight active. Okay, these are the times that you need to be in there, not fooling around the rest of the season. And I've kind of done a little bit of things where I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to get quota hunts in these areas where I am more likely to see a mature deer, because the rut's different over there. Like, it could be like a late September rut in that area. So I'll try to draw those quota hunts to keep me out of the areas that I know I'm not going to be productive anyways. And it paid off this year. I went to a quota area and got on a buck that was behind a doe. And I found his area, went in the next day, killed him. first hour. So, and that doesn't really happen a lot, but I was never really using that style before, until I was like, okay, let's try to change something up and try to learn from all the mistakes that you've made in the past, and see how that kind of pans out. And it's panned out for me this year. So,
yeah. What you said before, you know, that buck that, you know, is showing up the third and the fourth, and it's crazy. It's crazy how accurate that can be sometimes. And I'm not saying every deer is like that, but the more observe it, and the more I cross-reference sightings and trail cam pictures, and I'm just looking at some of the deer. Like, I'm sitting in my living room now, and I'm just looking at some of the deer on the wall. Like, there's several that I have killed that way. That, you know, it was like a 2 to 5 day window where they were in a certain area the year before, and that's when I killed them the following year. And I don't know what it is. You know, I think they all have their spots. They like to be early season. And I think, you know, they tend, as long as they don't get killed there, I think they tend to just stay there, for that right. time of year. And then, you know, as does start to come into, you know, estrus, and they kind of leave those areas, because usually it's, you know, an early season spot where a buck lives is not where they spend during the rut. There's usually some sort of shift. It could be huge, it could be small, but they usually shift somewhat, and then they go to the same areas where they spend kind of the pre-rut, and they mark their territory doing a lot of rubbing and scraping. And then often where they're actually breeding those first, you know, 2 weeks of November here in the Midwest, it could be a whole nother area. You know, it could be a mile to the north, or, you know, 2 miles, 3 miles to the west. And it's just crazy how year to year I get them in the same small areas in that short little window. And I, you know, I've really come to realize and see, like, these little short patterns. You know, if you can capitalize on these little short patterns that these deer and these properties or these areas show you, you know, and they show it to you if you're observant. And if you're diligent with your scouting, and, you know, don't just flip through your cameras, you know, your trail cam pictures, and, you know, looking for the big racks, you know, like, analyze the pictures. And when you look at them, look at the dates, and look at when you had that deer on the year before, if you did, or when you do get one, you know, if you get a random big buck, you know, or a good 3-year-old or something, and it's, you know, that early November timeframe or something, you know, keep that in the back of your mind coming into the next year. Like, hey, this deer was here. I've seen it time and time and time again. There's a very often they show up in that same area during that same time frame. So you guys got to kind of be ready to capitalize on that. And it tried to stockpile a lot of those areas. And if you can, learn that about those individual deer. And I imagine, you know, where you guys are at, that's, you know, Midwest hunting is easier compared to a lot of parts of the country, no doubt about it. Like, we, you know, there's the deer are more visible, their travel patterns are often more funneled, you know, the food sources are mostly a lot of times kind of open, trail cameras, the strategy is pretty straightforward, so it's a little easier here. But I gotta think that those patterns that they keep from year to year, and where they utilize their season and spend their time, you know, is kind of universal. You know, I really think that's something that if guys started keying in on that a little more, that would really help them, you know, help them with their success.
No, for sure. You know, I think I told Chase this early on in the season. You know, I realized this year I didn't scout enough, you know, like that's just the plain reality to it. And with Florida, I feel like every year I learn that's more and more paramount, because you're right. These properties have those little nuanced trends, and you find them. Chase has proven that on his private land a lot. I mean, he's got these deer, and I don't say private land to be like disparaging or anything like that. That just, he happens to be able to monitor a real like closed environment, and it shows certain things really, really predictably. And I think the biggest challenge here is just the lack of open areas, right? Like, there are so many areas that are just thick, and it's nothing but pine trees, or there's no fields, and it's a lot of work finding where those areas are that hold that unique moment. And I think that's where trail cameras are really going to come in for me, and maybe anybody else hunting environments like this, just because I need eyes in a bunch of different places where I can let those cameras soak and then analyze that. Like you're saying, it seems to really make a whole lot of sense to be taking that approach.
Yeah, it's a great tool, but I always caution guys. Like, I see a lot of guys now, especially kind of the younger guys, they rely on trail cameras for everything. And now with, like, cell cameras coming out, I mean, it's just, It's just crazy. They've changed the game. But I encourage guys to not – trail cameras miss a lot. They do miss a lot. I love the strategy of letting them sit out and soak. I love the strategy of putting them in an area that's not sensitive and checking them more often, like on, maybe like on a field edge or something. There's certain spots where I'll check them often and just wait for that buck to show up on that food source. And then I know, because I've done my scouting, I know where to hunt him further back in the cover. So it's the trail camera's in a spot where I can, check frequently because it's away from their bedding. It's in an area where, they might interact with humans or farmers often. But if I get a picture of them, 8, 9 o'clock after dark or something, that's cool. That was the goal, because now I know he's in the area and I know where I can hunt him because I've scouted the area and I know where the good bedding areas and that sort of thing. But don't rely on trail cameras too much. Not saying you guys do, but I've just kind of cautioned that to people. Like I see it all the time. Like guys are just buying like dozens and dozens of cameras, and they're just basically hunting off the cameras and spending so much time checking that. And now it's to the point where guys are just kind of sitting on their butt waiting for their phone to ping. And, good Lord, there still has to be some woodsmanship in it. And I think if you can use, a mix of technology and a mix of woodsmanship, I think that's probably, I think that's probably the best mix to use. You gotta still have good old fashioned woodsmanship sometimes, and the trail cameras just a lot of times just miss a lot of it. It's just a really small little snippet of what's really going on,
right? And if you rely on the trail camera entirely, it's like the wind may never be right for that spot,
right?
It may be something where you're like, well, I'm not going in there because the wind's not right, or this, but the deer could have been coming from a totally different way, and if you'd have sat that observation sit before, you may have found that, or you could have sat off of it on a different wind direction, and maybe you kill the deer because you actually went in there as opposed to not going in there because you never thought the wind was right. So I definitely agree with that.
Well, Andy, I want to be sensitive to your time. So I've got one parting question for you, unless Chase has got a question that we haven't worked through yet.
Yeah, shoot.
I got so many questions to ask. We'd be here all night. So
maybe we can convince Andy to come back on a second time.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, in all seriousness, I like to ask this question because, especially with it being a spontaneous question, you don't have any, you didn't know this question was coming. It really reveals what people think and really reflect on a lot. And that is, if you could go back and tell your 18-year-old self this one piece of advice to change your hunting path, to change the outcome of maybe other hunts that happened, or just shorten the learning curve, what singular piece of advice would you give 18-year-old Andy?
I probably would say, don't get caught up too much in the big buck craze. It was weird. My second year of hunting, I killed a really big Michigan buck. And it kind of set me down that path of bigger deer, because when people saw it, they were like, oh my gosh, you'll never kill another one this size. And it felt great, that everybody was talking about this buck and it was a rare deer. And it kind of that put me down a path of going after big deer. And I can't say I regret that, but I see some friends and people I know that, come from a strong, like, hunting family, a strong culture of hunting. And, they go out and they don't really worry about big racks. They go out and they spend time with their family and they fill the freezer. And I see some of their pictures and they got bigger smiles than I do, with my giant, my big giant that I think is so cool. And this guy's holding a little forky up in northern Michigan, and he's smiling ear to ear. So I guess what I would just tell myself And I see other guys too. Like some of those guys are like, you know, they're shooting, you know, maybe a 6 point or a small eight. And they're like, oh man, he's not quite what I wanted or whatever. You know, hunting is different to everybody. And it's easy to kind of feel like you're maybe less than or something if you're not putting a big buck on the wall every year. You know, nowadays it's such so glorified. But just remember, I guess, hunting is different to everybody. And, you know, I don't think for everybody it needs to be about big bucks. Like, you know, those – I sometimes get jealous of those families that it's, you know, it's the son and the dad and the grandfather – and the aunt and the uncle, and they go up and they have a good old fashioned deer camp and they put some deer down. They, you know, they have a good time. And, you know, I've never done that. I've never had anything like that in my life. Like I am pretty much loner on my road trips. If maybe hunt with one other guy. And that's kind of just been my style, but I see that sometimes and I'm like, man, that would be cool. You know, there's just no pressure there. It's just having fun hunting. So, I guess my advice would be, you know, find out what makes you happy with hunting and just stick with that and screw what anybody else says. And, you know, just do what you want. Hunting can be different for every person.
I love that. That's a great message, man. So, well, with that, my friend, if you will hang on 1 second, I'm going to close this out, but I want to chat with you afterwards.
Hey, well, why don't you tell everybody where they can find them if they'd like to.
That would make sense too, wouldn't it? Yeah.
About
yeah,
Andy.
That sounds like the hostly thing to do.
Well, there's not much out there. I don't have a video, a YouTube channel or anything like that. I do have an Instagram, but you know, I don't take it too serious. I post some hunting stories on there and some personal pictures once in a while, but I'm not even that active on that. So there's okay. A few podcasts out there that I've been on, Wired to Hunt, but my Instagram is Bow Hunting Dad. If you want to follow me, go ahead. Don't get your hopes up too high, but you know, I'm not trying to make a show or anything like that. It's just, you know, I like hunting and I like talking with guys that are excited about hunting and hardcore and just surrounding myself with those types of guys. So that's about it.
Guys, I have thoroughly enjoyed this time. I would have let the clock run on even further, but it's pretty late when we're recording this, and I know that Andy's pretty busy. So maybe what we teased earlier, maybe we can convince him to come on for part two one day and talk about scouting or some other topic that you guys pick. But until next time, take Andy's advice and get out there and do some scouting and enjoy the great outdoors. Four in the
morning, red eye. Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, a mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.